Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Paul Kingsnorth is a sign of hope, both to the church and perhaps also to the world. He's a public intellectual who's made a journey through modernity, striding across the stepping stones of ecological activism, through Buddhism and paganism, and finally, and rather surprisingly and reluctantly, ended up becoming a Christian. Just to make the mix a little more exotic, he's moved to rural Ireland and become Eastern Orthodox. It wasn't at all obvious his journey was going to follow this trajectory. He read history at Oxford and edited the university's longest-running student newspaper, the Cherwell, moved on, perhaps obviously, to become a leader writer for The Independent in the early 90s, and then was drawn away by environmentalism, and his pilgrimage began. Why is he a sign of hope? Because he is intelligent, every man, because he's asked the questions that modernity presents us with, and they brought him to Christ. Because he has a formidable intellect, and he's interrogating the collapsing timbers of Western culture, in order to understand how faith and intelligent human purpose can resist the corrosive effects of modernity and the cultural incoherence into which the West is slipping and sinking. Whenever he speaks and he writes, he commands an immediate, attentive audience. There is a depth of clarity and authenticity in the way he thinks, the way he writes, and the way he speaks. Judge for yourself. He joins me now. The story of how you came to Christianity is fascinating. You seem to have tried all the reasonable, viable alternatives, both in terms of paganism, environmentalism, and Buddhism, all perfectly honourable ways of trying to make sense of the world. And yet you got propelled into Christianity. Listening to the way you've told your story, it does sound to me like the Hound of Heaven poem. Can you explain a little bit about how you found yourself propelled from those honourable utopianisms into the orthodoxy and the kingdom of heaven?
Well, it was a strange journey. Yes, I didn't know about the Hound of Heaven poem until after I became a Christian. Then one of my friends sent it to me and I thought, oh yes, right. Clearly this has been happening for a long time. I suppose I think I'd been on really a religious / spiritual search for a very long time. You realize from a very young age that something's wrong with the world and then you go looking for what it is. It's very common. And I went looking through politics and activism and world-changing utopianism to some degree, as you say, and then into more explicitly spiritual paths, certainly beginning with Buddhism and then moving through kind of nature religions. But I've always been a great nature lover, so I thought that what I needed was a nature religion. All that time I was getting closer to some sense of God, although I would never have used that dread word, because it felt to me like there was something beyond all of this that was not purely explicable through even through more slightly rationalist methods like Buddhist practice, which, you know, is a very powerful practice in many ways, certainly in terms of learning about the nature of the self, but doesn't take you to wherever I was looking to go. And of course, if you're in the West and you're looking for spiritual truth, the last place you go is Christianity for any number of historical reasons. And so I didn't want to look there. But I mean, really, a lot of things happened to me. But I mean, what I really did was I got to a point where I said a prayer, actually, and I said to God, okay, if you exist, show me what's going on. Tell me what to do. Who are you? What's the truth? Show me where I should be going. Very soon after that, actually, I started just falling over Christians every 5 minutes, as if, you know, I was getting emails from people. I had friends who were Christian turning up and talking to me. I was getting people talking to me on Facebook randomly about Christianity. All sorts of things were happening. And then at the time I was practicing Wicca, which is a kind of pagan nature religion, and things started happening to me. I began to have dreams about Jesus and I began to feel like I was being dragged towards Christianity and I didn't really want to be. I was very reluctant, a sort of C.S. Lewis type reluctant convert. But really, I felt like by the end, I felt like I was bodily dragged out of what I was doing. And I sort of had to concede who was doing the dragging. And this was all very unusual. And one of the reasons I thought it was probably real was that I didn't want it to be. I'd gone looking for the other things, Buddhism and nature, paganism, because I thought they'd give me something I wanted, and to some degree they did. But Christianity, I wasn't looking for anything. I didn't want to be a Christian. I thought, I don't like Christians and I don't believe in Christianity, so this can't be real. But it is real. And then, of course, when I started when I sort of accepted what was happening, and I started looking into it and talking to people and reading properly and realizing that Christianity wasn't what I'd thought it was, then kind of the journey began, and I ended up as an Orthodox Christian here in Ireland, not a Catholic, an Orthodox Christian for any number of equally complex reasons. But I found that, if you go to two or three Orthodox liturgies, it's impossible to stop going back. I found it's like a sort of spiritual drug. That's where I've ended up, and I was baptized just over 2 years ago. And of course, what I discovered then was that that was the beginning of the journey and not the end of it. But it's been a very long journey, but it's not such an unusual one in the West. I hear a lot from people since I started writing about it who've been on quite similar paths, so it's happening to a lot of people, I think.
The same thing happened to me, not to turn the conversation around to me, but to look at the common elements. The same thing, I don't like Christians, I don't like the church. I would like the solution to be anything but Christianity. And then an enormous surprise to discover that the Christianity I didn't want it to be was something very different from what it turned out to be. Without looking to be partisan at all, because I too wanted to be Orthodox, I found myself sent to an Orthodox monastery during my time at Anglican Theological College, fell in love with it. And my prayer was afterwards, Lord, how soon can I become Orthodox, please? And the answer to me has been, you can't be, which has been a surprise to me. It doesn't matter what the reasons are. I don't need to know them. I just know a red light when I see one. But it'd be quite interesting to have you reflect on the difference. Obviously, your vocation is to be Orthodox, and that's fine. And we're not trying to persuade people to move one way or the other. But do you have reflections on the complementary relationship between East and Western historic Christianity at the moment?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, if you decide you're going to become a Christian, the question is then, well, what's the church then? Because there are thousands of them. Luckily, I'm not in America, where apparently there are 10,000 Protestant churches to choose from. So it's slightly easier. But, there are still obviously different denominations or churches claiming to be the church. So I'm English, so I suppose culturally it would make sense for me to be Anglican. I live in Ireland, so it would be easiest to be Catholic. A lot of Catholic friends. And really, when I started to become Christian, I was going to the local Catholic church. I would go to the Mass sometimes. I would go to the adoration in the church down the road, and I would go to Anglican churches too. And again, I was praying. Didn't really know what that meant, but I was just saying, I had this thing that I asked repeatedly. I said, please send me a priest. I was praying. I said, send me a priest and send me to the right church. And I thought, well, when I meet a priest who comes to talk to me, then I'm going to know that's where I'm supposed to be. And I would spend a long time just sort of sitting in Catholic churches that I happened to pass and hoping a priest would turn up, but none of them did. And eventually I ended up going to the Orthodox Monastery in Shannonbridge, which has just opened up a few years ago, just before I became Christian, actually, which is the first Orthodox monastery in Ireland, or at least the first one since the schism. So the first one for 1,000 years, which was opened by the Romanian church, but it's very pan-Orthodox. And I plucked up the courage to go to a liturgy, and there was a priest, and he started to talk to me. And one of the things I was impressed by was the fact that he told me to slow down and take my time, didn't offer to baptize me tomorrow to add to his congregation. He said, look, it's a big deal. It's a long journey. And he gave me things to do, and he asked me to keep talking to him. And so I kept going back to that. And I was very, very struck by the power of the Orthodox liturgy. I've never felt anything like that. I don't see that in a Catholic mass. Don't see it in an Anglican church. I'd never experienced anything like it, because church services, in England when I was growing up, were more like a sort of lecture with some songs. And the Orthodox liturgy is a full body kind of immersion in something that is very old and very deep. And that was, I think, probably the main reason that I became Orthodox. But there were also, I think, there was something within me that said, look, I want to go to the church that is the least changed, that has been the least changed by the modern world, that is the least worldly church. And I think that remains the Orthodox Church. And I think that the Western churches have, for all sorts of reasons, tried to modernize themselves over the last several decades to meet the needs of the world. Rational reasons, I suppose. The Orthodox Church has never had to go through modernity in the way that the Western churches have. So it's never had to sort of meet the need in quite the same way. It was too busy struggling with communist oppression to have to worry about modernizing itself. But it's remained truest to its tradition, I think, compared to any Western church. And that was a powerful thing. And then once I realized that the Orthodox Church is not a sort of a strange foreign thing that's arrived in the West, but is actually our ancestral church, as is the Catholic Church. Before the schism, we were all, there was no Orthodox or Catholic. I realized that actually this was not me sort of pretending to be Eastern or something. This was me finding a way back to the old roots of what Christianity was. where I came from as well. So all of those reasons have taken me kind of deep into the tradition, I think. And I have a feeling now, to answer your question in a long-winded way, I have a feeling that there's something that the Orthodox can really bring to the West. And I have a feeling that the very large number of Eastern European immigrants that have come here over the last 25 years are bringing that. You know, they're really bringing back something very strong and very old that we have wandered away from, I think, in the West. And I think that's one reason some Western people are attracted to Orthodoxy, because it can take us back there. And it can probably teach Western people lessons as well. So we'll see. We'll see how that plays out. But I've got a feeling that there's a good reason that this is happening.
That's very interesting and also really quite exciting. The image I have is of an unbroken umbilical cord. It's a bad metaphor, really, because in order to be born, you have to cut it. But there are times when umbilical cord is necessary. And certainly one of the things that strikes me about the problem of the Western Church is its lack of confidence, which presumably is partly a result of never having come to terms with the implications of the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment and the body blow that the Renaissance also produced. It's taken 400 or 500 years, but a whole series of cultural, intellectual and rational elements seem to have made my generation, at any rate, very unsure of themselves and unable to free themselves from this false notion of progress that we imbibed in the schoolroom and through the media and all through almost every single outlet. But Orthodoxy has an antidote to it by reversing the teleology of authenticity, looking back to the apostolic era rather than to whatever distortions development and modernity have imposed on us. Do you think it's as basic as that we, the West, needs to be rebooted and reminded that actually Orthodoxy always got it right and the West gave itself for a mess of progressive pottage that it shouldn't have done?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I certainly wouldn't say the Orthodox Church has always got things right. It's made lots of errors and done many terrible things, as all churches have managed to do over history. But I think in theological terms, it has mostly got it right as well, as much as I can see. Obviously, I'm not a theologian, but there's some... The fact that Mount Athos has existed for 1,000 years and the liturgy has been said in the same way in that place for 1,000 years, not because of some rote attachment to mindless tradition, but because it's a living faith. It's an enormously powerful thing, and there's absolutely nothing like it in the West. And I think that what's happened in the West is, at least since the Reformation, but probably since long before that, you could argue about where the sort of rot sets in. But the Western Church, I think, becomes sort of overly rational and then becomes overly worldly. And as you say, is then kind of knocked sideways by the scientific revolution and Darwin and the Industrial Revolution and modernity, and doesn't really have answers to those things. And rather than, because so much has been sort of fiddled around with in the late Middle Ages, by the time you get to modernity, there's not a tradition where you can turn back and say, well, you know, we've been saying this liturgy for 1,000 years, so we're going to keep doing it. And this is the tradition of the Desert Fathers, and we still practice it, so we'll keep doing that. And I'm very struck by the fact that, you know, the Orthodox Church, in different forms, survived centuries of Ottoman oppression, and then it survived a century of Bolshevik oppression of the most horrific kind. I mean, the stories of what the communists did to the church in Romania and Russia are just unbelievable. And in a strange way, that strengthened the Orthodox Church, I think, because I do have a feeling that Christians are always strongest when they're persecuted, actually, and always weakest when they're most comfortable and too close to power. And so I think maybe that the Western Church is striking this kind of devil's bargain with modernity and saying, well, hey, if we modernize too, people will want to come along. It was precisely the opposite to what people actually needed. What people actually want is a church that says, this is not the world, this is the church, and it teaches the same thing it's always taught. Whereas, as I say, in the West, the church has tended to bend with the wind. And I wonder how much of that is generational. I wonder how much of that is a kind of a boomer thing and it will change. You know, there are some signs that things will change. And the church is, you know, it always renews itself. It kind of falls and rises again. So anything could happen. But I do have a feeling that Orthodoxy might be able to bring a kind of strong core back to the Western faith.
I'm going to hold you to the phrase, the church always renews itself, as we come to the more apocalyptic end of our conversation following your unheard lecture the other day. But one of the things I did in the 1980s was I smuggled Bibles into the Soviet Union and met underground Christians and was astonished at their resilience and their courage and their bravery. But what astonished me equally was the way in which Orthodoxy has simply erupted since 1989. I mean, the population of practicing Christians was immensely and bravely very small. It was absolutely inconceivable in 1989 or with a decade afterwards that somehow, I don't know, I think the figure is something like 70% of Russians nowadays identify as Russian Orthodox, whatever the value of that is, still from a standing start of 0.0 something percent. It's quite incredible. And it must, leaving aside the whole Russian-Ukraine conflict for the moment, it is still unbelievable that within one generation, the Russian Orthodox Church should have found itself with monasteries overflowing and vocations to the priesthood and full churches and liturgies being entered into by a large section of the population. It's mind-boggling.
Something similar happened on Mount Athos, which in the 80s, by all accounts, was very depopulated. There were monasteries there that were just inhabited by sort of half a dozen elderly monks, and it looked like it was going the way of, say, monasticism in Ireland, which is pretty much what's happened here. And there was a huge renewal, and it's overflowing now. I went to Athos last year. It's very, very common to meet monks in their 20s. And similarly in Romania as well, by the way, there was a big surge in the Romanian church after the revolution, after they overthrew Ceausescu. And again, you can go to Romania and, you know, Romanian Christians will say, oh, it's not as good as it used to be. It's not as strong as it used to be. And I say to them, have you any idea what it's like in the West? You can go to a monastery in Romania now and you can, again, meet 20-something monks, 20-something nuns. You know, there's a real energy there, which you just do not see here. And it's a new energy. It's not elderly Christians sort of living out their lives. It doesn't feel like a dying faith. It feels like something's going on. So it does feel like there's something happening. And I think this is why people like me end up in a place that we'd never have expected. If you told me 5 years ago I was going to end up as an Orthodox Christian, I would not have believed you, to say the least.
No, one of the exciting things about the Christian journey is that I think almost whatever stage you're at, it's a huge surprise and something that one could never have foreseen. I mean, I found myself, someone once said to me when I was more in the public eye about 15 years ago, if you had magical powers and you were Archbishop of Canterbury, what one thing would you do to renew the church? And I found myself with an insight I didn't think I had or didn't know I had, which might have been the Holy Spirit saying I would put everything into the renewal of monasteries. Because it seems to me that only the, you know, it was the monastic life that saw off the Vikings and preserved culture and deepened the presence of prayer in the communities. Peter Ackroyd has this extraordinary sense that, I think he said in one of his books that 80% of the ghost stories throughout the world were written by English authors. And he wondered if it wasn't some form of displacement after access to the saints was removed by the destruction of the monasteries in England, producing an enormous psychic wound that again would have broken this cord back to the beginning of the church's life as one of its consequences. Every so often you hear of Western bishops who are putting some resources into the refounding of small monastic communities, which seems to me to be a sensible priority. And I don't suppose it was a deliberate ploy in Orthodoxy. It presumably just happened automatically as part of the cultural, spiritual life and priorities, did it?
It's very interesting what you say about England, actually. I hadn't heard that theory from Peter Ackroyd before. It's very intriguing because it's absolutely the case that the English are the masters of ghost stories and ghost sightings, actually. I've always felt like English Christianity started to die with the destruction of the monasteries. That was the point at which the church effectively became the world. Suddenly the head of the church is a king, you know, rather than a bishop. That's an astonishing thing. And that's the point at which suddenly you have not got monks praying for you anymore, you know, and that really matters, certainly from an Orthodox perspective. And I think the other thing about Orthodoxy, perhaps, is that there have never been different monastic orders in Orthodoxy. There's just monasteries. You have monasteries, male monasteries and female monasteries. They all practice the same thing. And all Orthodox lay people are daily kind of living a version of the monastic rule. It's a worldly version that's not so difficult, but it's still a version of the same thing. So you don't have all of the sort of different monastic orders slightly competing with each other either. And it does seem to be an absolutely central part of Orthodoxy. I think if Mount Athos ever falls or the monasteries ever fall, then the church dies, you know, it just dissolves away. And I do have a feeling that monasticism and hermeticism is absolutely central to the faith. I think it always has been, at least since the Desert Fathers. And like you say, in the West, it's not exactly died, but it's certainly faded away. And maybe the return of that will change things.
One of the things I've always been impressed with in Orthodoxy, and if it had been left up to me, would have attracted me to join, was the way in which the Orthodox laity have always had a very keen appetite for recognizing holiness, and have taken priority over the ecclesiastical administration in the recognition of saints and the Stadets. Whereas in the West, although we've had extraordinary outbreaks of holiness and a devotion to the saints, there's always been a sense that the bureaucracy has a fairly tight hold on the recognition of sanctity. And in one sense, of course, that's very helpful for keeping us free from the bogus, of which there's always an inordinate amount. But yet there's this imbalance, because holiness always disturbs, it always upsets bureaucrats, it always shakes institutions, and so inevitably the people who live in the institution are going to be frightened of it. But the East does seem to have a surer intuitive sense of recognizing it and validating it and celebrating it.
Mm. And I wonder how much of that is due to the structure of the church, because my worldly reason for finding it difficult to be Catholic, quite apart from the fact that I was led to Orthodoxy in the same way you were probably taken to the Catholic Church. And my worldly reason would just be my real problem with the centralized power of the church. And as you say, the existence of the kind of the magisterium and the very, very tight definitions of doctrine that everybody must sign up to, and the kind of official, as you say, the naming of saints. It's very, the culture is quite different in Orthodoxy. I mean, in Orthodoxy, of course, we have bishops and we have patriarchs, and there's a hierarchy and there's a structure. But because there's no centralized dogmatic authority which tells everybody what they have to think about every issue, and because the tradition in the Orthodox Church is that, you know, firstly, nobody wants there to be another ecumenical council because they don't think any of the leaders are holy enough. So the theology doesn't change, it's just there. We don't have a pope who can decide to tell us something about something one day in an encyclical, and we just have to all do it. But even if there was a council, the tradition in Orthodoxy is always that there's an ecumenical council, the bishops come back and they say, we've decided this, but then the laity has to approve it. And they don't approve it through a vote, they approve it through either just doing it or not doing it. So if the council, you know, if there was some ecumenical council and all the bishops decided to rewrite the liturgy, and they came back and said, right, everyone, we're doing a new Novus Ordo version of the liturgy, they would just refuse it. And the other thing is that the churches are autocephalous, so the Russian church is not the Romanian church, is not the Greek church, and so they can do different things. So, and that leads to some chaos, like there's two different calendars in the Orthodox Church, which is not ideal. But I'd prefer that to a kind of centralized authority, which, as you say, will always, whenever you have a centralized power system, it will always defend itself. It will always become corrupted, and however holy it tries to be, it's always going to end up being worldly. So the more, in a way, weirdly enough, the more divided the church is, the holier it has a chance of being.
I like that very much. I suppose it's partly about checks and balances. You've no idea how much, after having been an Anglican, dogma and catechism attracts me. I go, oh, look, a dogma. That's nice.
Well, I can see that. Yeah.
I haven't said, I'd heard of dogmas, but I never met one before. This is wonderful. I'm thrilled to have something so substantial in my hands and heart. But I rather think that it may be in the West that the renewal of the Catholic laity may partly be the answer to restoring the kind of equilibrium we've been talking about. Certainly, without wanting to be rude to them, the hierarchy, who are all my age, seem to be hostage to modernity and to some of the most impoverished parts of Western culture, and have lost sight of actually the rootedness of the Catholic tradition. And if there's anything apart from the Holy Spirit directly that can change it, it might be being accountable to a more muscular laity who stamp their feet and say, actually, this is impoverished nonsense, we're not going to do it. But if you did have a more muscular laity, I think I could cope. I would sleep more easily, is for the same reasons that you suggest, at night with an over-doctrinaire dogma. But I still, as an ex-Anglican, I can't rid myself of the delight of dogmatic certainty. It comes to me like a cold shower after a very hot day.
Yes, I feel the same about that. I mean, one of the reasons I became Orthodox, again, if I'm rationalizing it, is that I did want to be taught what to do. You know, the thing about the journey I've been on, and it's a very, very typical journey in the West, is because we're all such radical individualists, we think we can invent our own spirituality. So usually we'll just take a bit of Wicca here, and we'll take a bit of paganism there, and we'll take a bit of Buddhism here, and or if we decide we're going to become Christian, we'll sort of do the bits we like, and then we'll leave out the awkward stuff that seems a bit difficult for us. And I didn't want to do that. I was actually very conscious of the fact that I wanted to join a tradition and be told what the truth was. And then I was going to follow it, even if I didn't like it all, and see what it did to me. And I think that's how all real faiths work. Actually, they have a system and the system is cohesive. You can't bend the system and change the system. It might develop organically, but it develops slowly. And it's designed to do something to you. And if you start taking the bits out you don't like, then you've just got the modern world. And so it's important. There's a balance between having the right teaching and sticking to it, obviously having the dogma, but then not allowing the dogma to fossilize to such a degree that, as you say, it doesn't let the holiness in.
That's so interesting. Again, I was so thrilled when I began to go to masses. I went to mass at the same time as the Anglican Eucharist for about 2 years, mainly because my wife became a Catholic and so it was the right thing to do. But the effect of it was to see both systems at work. And I realized what a quicksand the and again, I don't mean this to be rude about Anglicanism, but the trouble is if you don't tell the truth, you can't have a sensible conversation. But the way the poor clergy had to be entertainers and to seduce congregations into their liturgy, into their worship, pleasing them, stroking them, giving them the kind of fast food menu they thought they wanted in order that they shouldn't go away and try one or the other 1,000 Protestant outlets. Whereas when it came at least to the historic church, the mass was a mass, the liturgy was a liturgy, and it didn't matter what you thought about it. You just turned up and it was done to you. And as it was done to you, it began to change you. And it's this notion of consenting to being changed by something that's both benevolent and threatening at the same time. Threatening, of course, because it's threatening to your ego and your autonomy and all those bits of your fingernails that are locked into crevices shouting, "I'm not going to move," get quite rightly threatened. But it's very countercultural for anyone brought up in since the Second World War.
Yeah, and that's the really interesting thing, is it's become radically countercultural now to submit yourself to a tradition. And people who come from outside the West don't necessarily have this problem. I mean, you could be a British Muslim, and if you want to go to the mosque and follow Islam, there it is. Presumably, I'm no expert on this, but it's there. Actually, my wife is from an Indian family and her family is Sikh, and you can go down to the Sikh Gurdwara and there is Sikhism, and it hasn't bent itself to do whatever it imagines the world wants it to do. It's the same tradition that has been taught for 500 years. The whole purpose of the modern project, I think, is to liberate the individual and to tell us that once we live in a world where we can make our own choice about everything, we're going to be happier. Sometimes that's true, in a limited way, certainly. But in other ways, it's fundamentally not. And I think we've got to the point in the modern world where we're realizing that living in this marketplace of endless choice of everything will actually drive you mad. And certainly when it comes to faith, things are either true or they're not. You know, this is either the truth or it isn't the truth. Christ is either who we say he is or he isn't. And there's no real compromise on that. And if he is, you have to follow the teaching he laid down. So you need to go and find it. And then, as you say, you need to submit yourself to it. Rather than imagining, I mean, if I get to the position where I think that I know enough about Christianity that I can change it because Paul Kingsnorth has seen a bit he doesn't like, then I'm in a serious state of spiritual pride, and that was exactly what I didn't want to do. So I submit myself to it, and you know, are there bits of the church that I feel uncomfortable with? Yeah. Are there things I'm not sure about? Yes. But I do them, and then the mystery is that the deeper you go into them, the more things start opening up and you go, oh, yes, that's why that's there. I didn't realize that. I didn't understand that. And it's the practice of it. But you have to, as you say, submit yourself to the existing structure and tradition and then just let it work on you. And then it works on you and mysteries happen. But that's very, very much against everything we've been taught to do and be.
So let's jump from that into the strengths and weaknesses of the machine. In one sense, if you and I are right, we might then go on to say, well, poor old secularism, it's had its day. It's produced sort of hyper-consumerism, hyper-subjectivism. People are being driven mad by it in the way that the tradition has always said they'd be mad. And so it must give way before something. And yet, at the same time, you're warning us that the way the machine has been developing, technologically at any rate, looks to be all-powerful, all-demanding, and all-controlling. How do we manage this dichotomy of the essential weakness of secularism in terms of the way it doesn't contour itself to the needs of the human soul, and the fact that we've somehow given birth to a technological event that we can't control anymore?
Well, I've been thinking about this for years, and I've been writing a series of essays about it specifically for the last 2 years. partly to try and explain it to myself and to work out what I think is going on. And the point I've got to, I think, and this is, it's not coincidental that my Christian journey has really started at the same time as I've been writing this. I think I wasn't explicitly writing Christian essays, but they can't stop going in that direction. But what I've realized, I think, is that every culture on earth is always caught around God. It's always caught around the divine and our culture's understanding of what the divine is. And it may manifest in different religions or faiths, but they always point towards where they think the divine is. And we've created a culture in the last several hundred years in the West where explicitly we've said, actually, we don't need that. We've gone beyond that. That was just a superstitious thing that people did in the past because they didn't have science. And now we know about science. And we know about, we can manipulate the world with technology. We're very, very clever at that. We don't need all of these old fairy stories about sky pixies and the rest of it. And that's sort of the story I grew up with. And on a shallow level, it's quite an attractive story. And it's a story that comes out of all the power that humans have now, because we can send rockets into space and create nuclear weapons and genetically modify things. And so we have this incredible technological ability that we've never had before. But I think we can't live without God. So what we're doing is we're turning this new technological matrix we've built, which I call the machine, which is a phrase I borrowed from many other writers in the past. We're turning that into a form of religion because we need a religion. We need to put something on the throne of the culture. And so what we're doing is we are, I mean, Chesterton said, if you don't worship something beyond the world, you worship the world. And above all, you worship the strongest thing in the world. And the strongest thing in the world is technology. So what we're doing is we're creating a kind of technological God. And you can see this very explicitly with AI at the moment. And you can see it very explicitly with the transhumanist movement, all of whose leaders very openly talk about how they're making God and creating God and becoming God. And we are attempting to create life, create new intelligence, control the planet, control the universe. And you know, that kind of creativity and control is what gods do. And we are trying to make ourselves gods because we haven't got a god anymore. And so I think what we're doing is sometimes explicitly and sometimes implicitly, we're taking this huge power we've got, confusing it with wisdom, imagining that we can create life and manage the world and turning ourselves into gods, which of course is exactly what the snake in the Garden of Eden told us we could do if we ate the apple. So in that sense, it's not a new story. It's the playing out of a very old one. And one of the reasons I was so struck by Christianity, incidentally, when I became a Christian, was reading that Genesis story again for the first time, almost as if I'd never seen it before, and thinking, hang on, this isn't just some old myth from 3,000 years ago. This is the story of human life every day. And here we are, and the rebellion continues. So I think it's the rebellion against God made manifest in technological form. Because we can't live without God, we're trying to create God, and it's going to end the way it always ends.
One of the surprises to me is the way in which, like you, when I read Genesis, I was blown away by the obvious meaning as opposed to the pseudo-scientific invitation to tell us how things happened. And the obvious meaning seemed to me to be, just because you're capable of doing something, are you able to live with the consequences of what you've chosen to do in this capacity? And I would have thought, if any century ever taught a generation that we were unable to live with the consequences of things we'd chosen to do, it would have been the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st. And I genuinely don't understand. I mean, I worked in a university for 25 years, and I would go around parroting what I thought Genesis was all about, but nobody seemed particularly interested, even though I thought it opened up the possibility of having one of the wisest conversations one might have, but it simply wasn't on anyone's radar. And I guess it's partly because people are so seduced by the idea, well, it's a conjunction of power and fear, isn't it? Underneath it all is a fear we're going to die, a fear we're going to destroy ourselves, a fear we're going to fail. And at the same time, the seduction of the possibility of power delivering an antidote to that fear, even though it never does. And one of the things surprised me amongst all very clever academics I worked with was that the really clever ones had never had a fresh philosophical idea after the age of 11. It was like, having proved themselves in whatever academic ability they were good at, they stopped thinking about life. And therefore, you know, they stopped doing any proper, I say proper philosophy, I mean, you know, asking the sensible basic questions. Why am I here? What am I doing? What am I hoping for? How might I get there or not? But it simply wasn't part of the intellectual culture at all. And it's almost as if still all the people we live amongst are either numbed by all the noise or all the diversion or all the things that consumerism throws at them, or just they've never been in a place where they started to ask the kind of questions that Genesis invites you to consider. And it's this, they haven't even started the journey.
I think something really revolutionary happened to our way of thinking as well in the 20th century. I was just reading Ian McGilchrist's new book, and he has, I'm sure you've come across his thesis about left and right hemisphere ways of seeing. And he's using a lot of brain science to basically back up the notion that the Western world, whenever this happened, Industrial Revolution or Enlightenment or maybe earlier than that, has gone into this very left hemisphere dominated way of seeing the world. Very rational, very controlling, very mechanistic. And that allows us to create these great technological wonders, but it also blinds us to what the actual big picture of the thing is. And it seems to me that we have completely forgotten in the West today how to understand what religion is. And we've also completely forgotten how to understand what mythology is and how those things interact. You see that very often in the way that people look at the Book of Genesis, and you either get a sort of Richard Dawkins argument that this is nonsense because it doesn't make scientific sense, or you get a sort of extreme evangelical notion that this is supposed to be a scientific textbook, and so we all once rode on dinosaurs. And both of these are this kind of ludicrous literalist reductionism. But it's like we don't understand what religion is, what the sacred stories are, and we don't know how to read them, and we don't know how to understand what the liturgy does, or we don't know how to read myths or creation stories. There's a whole part of the human mind where people used to understand the level on which this operated, and we don't get it now. We think like almost like machines. We're very good at analyzing things, but we can't step back and let them work on us. And a story has to work on you, and a religion has to work on you. And so we don't, because we've cut out this vast area of human life, which is what we call religion, spirituality, mythology, it's like we don't have access to a lot of things that our ancestors once did. So we don't have access to a whole layer of reality now that all of the people of the past would have understood. And so it's like we're blind in one eye, I think. We think we can see 100 miles.
It's true, but we also don't have any people leading the way to do that. I don't think I'm breaking any Chatham House rules, but I'll be careful nonetheless. I was part of a group of 10 academics or ex-academics who met both Peterson and McGilchrist in Cambridge, sort of a quiet backroom seminar, in which they both put their ideas in front of us. And it turned out, the way it had been organized, that most but not all of us were practicing Christians. And it was very interesting the way in which both Peterson and McGilchrist said, as we tested some of their ideas, they sidestepped the notion of their own allegiance to God. And one of the reasons why they don't come out as either believers or would-be believers is because if they declare for God in the public sphere, their intellectual foundations are going to be shattered. The whole world's going to dump on them as obscurantists. And in one sense, I don't mind that too much, because both of them are working covertly for the wisdom tradition. Peterson, as a psychologist, saying, my reading of the psychology of human beings is that you need much more than you've got and you're in trouble. And McGilchrist saying the same thing biologically and phenomenologically. But it's extraordinary that they're not in a position in terms of the culture wars to say, and I believe. And so we don't have anyone really in the public sphere commanding the respect of both the academy and the media and the person in the street, able to bridge this gap between the wisdom tradition and the impossibility of living in the circumstances that modernity has imposed on us.
Yeah, but I think that we're getting to the point where you have to make that stand. I mean, I find Jordan Peterson quite frustrating, to be honest, because he talks relentlessly about Christianity in the public sphere, and he talks as if he's a Christian, and he records videos about what the Christian churches would do. But then when you ask him if he believes in God, as you say, he sidesteps it. Or are you a Christian? He sidesteps it. And I think you've got to some point you've got to get off the fence. And actually, I think someone like Peterson, who basically talks about Christianity 90% of the time, would gain a great deal of strength from actually just committing himself and saying, I'm going to do this. I do wonder whether he can see the enormity of how he would have to be changed, and so he doesn't want to go there. Because it's one thing to talk about it and another thing to do it. But I don't know. I think maybe we've got to the point where, you know, people actually need to just stand up and say, look, I don't care what you think. This is what I believe. Assuming they do. I mean, who knows what people believe in? But at some point you have to make the jump. And I think maybe the time has passed where that kind of agnosticism works, because I'm not sure it even really persuades anyone. And if you really have convinced yourself that God is at the center of things and that needs to be said, then you kind of have to say it, you know?
I agree and I disagree. I can still see the virtue of the sort of agnostics luring unbelievers towards the kingdom of heaven by giving them the interpretative mechanism to find their way to faith. You know, Peterson saying,
look, it all works. Here are the, I'm really just presenting Christian virtues, and it works, so why don't you? I think for him, the considerable difficulty is, one is, I think he's too intellectually wedded to Carl Gustav Jung, and over lunch I did my very best to unwed him, but in 45 minutes over three courses, what can you do? And I think there is of course also the problem of that moment of surrender when you do the C.S. Lewis thing and you get down on your knees and reluctantly you say, yes, you're God and I'm not. The problem with Jung is he's one of the arch deceivers in terms of relocating the divine from out there to in here, completely improperly with terrible circumstances. And then the third thing for Peterson is that his whole audience will change immediately. But nonetheless, I agree with you. There comes a point, I think, where, you know, who knows if the point has passed for him or it's still to come, where you have to go with the courage of your convictions. But I still wish that McGilchrist and Peterson, since they're both effectively talking Christianity from their grasp of their own disciplines into the public sphere, I wish they'd joined the dots properly. And because without them, who do we have? I mean, there are so few public intellectuals. I mean, was Solzhenitsyn the last one? There have been very few people who've had the respect of our culture and at the same time have been determined Christians and paid a price for it.
I think that's true. And I wonder how that will change with the next generations, because I think things are getting pretty bad in our culture and in the world. And I think it's very difficult to be young now. And I think that the more intense the machine gets, the more horrible kind of individualist, consumerist, broken society gets, and it is going in that direction, the more people are going to reach towards truth and the more people are going to find it. And so I wonder whether the next generation is going to generate people who are much more, I mean, I think your generation and mine, the sort of the baby boomers and the Generation X people, we had the luxury of being a bit arch and ironic about the world. You know, we could sort of live comfortably in the post-war West and nobody ever made us fight and our culture wasn't collapsing and it was fine. And I don't think that's true anymore. And so I think that, as I said earlier, I think when Christians are up against the wall, as all humans are, they start producing the goods. So I wonder, as we get less comfortable, whether we're going to produce more public figures like that. I don't know. I hope so.
Let me ask you to tease out a bit again the question we started with, which is the vulnerability of secular culture without God. It can't sustain people's longing for the divine, and it certainly can't help us manage the existential crisis of who we are and what we're doing here. But the machine, as you described it rather frighteningly, is growing very strong, very quickly, and being promoted in a very determined way. How you ended up your lecture by saying, you know, rubbing your hands together and twinkling your eyes and saying to everyone, well, just pray. And you know, as a Staretz, that's an ideal way of finishing. But and you may be a Staretz or a budding Staretz, but people are entitled to ask you, yes, but how, Master? How do we do this thing?
Well, I mean, look, it's precisely because I'm the opposite of a Staretz that I ended up my talk like that, because I'm so new. I don't know anything else, but I also have a strong sense that when the center is collapsing, you go out to the periphery. And that's where the wisdom is to be found. And it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in this sort of wild Christian tradition, the Hermetic tradition, the monastic tradition, the Christians who lived in caves, the desert fathers, partly because that's just what I like doing as well. But it's also because I think actually those are the places where when the church is in trouble, or where society's in trouble, or when it's become too comfortable, or when it's collapsing, or something bad is happening in the center, you go to the edges, you go to the wilds, and you find the wisdom there. And you can either do that within, which I suppose we should all be doing anyway, or you can literally do it by going to live in a tomb like St. Anthony, or in a cave like St. Seraphim of Sarov, or any of the great saints of the tradition. I think we're at a point where we have to go within, we have to go to the margins, we have to go back to the source, actually. And again, it's one of the reasons I'm so grateful for Orthodoxy, because Orthodoxy, I think, really has still a connection with that source, with the living source. And I just have a sense that we need to go back, strip down all of the stuff that's grown up around the church, not just the modern stuff, but maybe some of the centralized, more comfortable stuff, and get to the heart of the matter. And I think that if you look at the history of Christianity, you can see that people having to repeatedly do that at different points in history. So it's not a new challenge. I have a feeling there are a lot of different ways to do that. I'm particularly obsessed with, as I say, these sort of wild Christians, the cave Christians, but there are many other ways to do it. But I think we have to sort of strip it all back and go back to the source and say, okay, well, if we really think society can't survive without God, and if we really think Christ is God, what does that mean? What does it actually mean to be a Christian? How do I live? How do I pray? What should I be doing? And the church can teach us that, but then we have to go and, you know, do it. And maybe we do it in communities with other people, and maybe we do it in communities online, at least to start with, so that we can meet. There's a lot of ways that people get together, but I just have a feeling that we're in that moment now where we have to strip it back to the bone again. I don't know exactly what that means, because I've been in the church for 2 years. It's an intuition, but I do. It's quite a strong one.
It resonates very strongly with me. One of the ways I see the church is a laboratory of prayer and holiness, and it does all kinds of things, but at its very best and at its centre, it helps people practice prayer, and it produces the transformation of holy people. And I think probably holy people are irresistible to the lost. It's a bit like, you know, that old Bisto advertisement they had in the 1950s. You have two children, and this scent comes in front of their nostrils, and they follow it because it's impossible not to follow it. And I think probably that's what...
Yes, I remember it, actually.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were old enough to remember it, but it's always struck me that holiness works like that.
Yeah, it was still around in the 70s. It's really important, because I think that when I look back on my spiritual journey, one of the things I was really looking for was wisdom. And I wanted elders, and I wanted saints, and I wanted wise people to show me what the truth was. There are very few of them around, especially in the West. I mean, I think there are usually few of them around anyway. But one thing that I've said a few times in some of my talks, and I'll probably say it again tomorrow, this weekend rather, is that, you know, we're not lacking in political solutions. We're not lacking in ideologies. We're not lacking in utopian ideas. We're not lacking in technological ideas. But we are lacking in saints. We're really seriously lacking in saints, and we're lacking in elders and staretses. And so we need to build them. They've got to come from somewhere. We have to make them, and it can be done because the church can show us how to make saints. And that's what we need. And like you say, when people ever meet if you ever meet a really holy person, you know, and you go towards them straight away and you say, show me the truth, tell me what to do. And you want to sit at their feet. And they're very rare. And perhaps they always have been, but they're much rarer in the West than they've ever been. And I think if the church could show us how to cultivate them again, we'd be in a different place, and maybe that will happen.
I remember one of the things that most influenced me, I'm not sure what the sub word is, subliminally, subconsciously. Once upon a time, I found my way into a monastery, and I was sharing a tower, the gate tower, with the abbot of Quor on the Isle of Wight, a Roman Catholic abbot, and he was in his 80s. And he said, would you come and serve for me at Mass? And so in this ancient pre-Reformation chapel, in an ancient pre-Reformation gatehouse, early in the morning in the dawn, I knelt by the altar as this radiantly holy man did the liturgy. And it wasn't anything that you could evaluate. It was just like, you know, the equivalent for the soul of sunbathing. The sun came out and it warmed your skin and it warmed your bones, and you thought, this is good. But as you say, there aren't very many of them. And I think probably the place we find most of them are in the monasteries. Paul, thank you so much. I hope the weekend goes very well. And thank you for writing the way you do. And thank you for your courage. And above all, the clarity of your thought and inviting the church to rediscover both prayer and holiness is something that can't go wrong, really. Thank you.
Thank you.